Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, a slightly rejuvenated Porkmeister, actually, let me tell you. And, of course, with Ms. Leslie Ann Jones in company with me. And Leslie Ann, we've had conversations in the past about the extent to which you've undergone cosmetic surgery. But actually, funnily enough, and the answer, of course, in your case was no, I seem to have beaten you to it.
Well, you have, and I'm dying to hear about it. How did it go? Did it hurt?
Well, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, I've been through the teeth whitening process, okay? Now, the thing is, you can't actually tell for a couple of days, and that's the truth of it. You know, the thing is, the work is done on your mouth, and what happens is, you sit under a light for 2 hours and the light, and your teeth are glossed with something, and then this ultraviolet beam is put on your teeth. You know what I mean? And
2 hours?
Yeah, 2 hours, yeah.
Oh, good God, how did you keep your mouth open for 2 hours? Mind you, in your case, probably not that hard.
Gosh, that's very nice, isn't it? Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. You know, let's open today's podcast with a few insults, shall we? No, what they do is they put a mould in your mouth to keep your lips open, you see, away from your teeth. And then the light shines on it. Although I say 2 hours, it's not 2 hours of continuous light. It's 15-minute sessions of light and about six of them, you know what I mean?
So are you telling me you actually had to sit there with your mouth wide open for 2 hours?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Oh, my God. How did you manage that?
Well, I don't know. But as I say, they put a mould into your mouth to keep your mouth open. You see what I mean? But the worst thing was you lie down when you're doing it, and my shoulders were really, really hurting last night when I got home, because it's not like, you know, lying on a sunbed or something like that. You can't actually move because the light is directed on your teeth, and, you know, you can't move your head around or anything like that, you know. So that was quite painful. But I won't know the outcome for another couple of days. Now, the thing is, it's almost like a Dulux paint chart. You know, they show you a level two of whiteness that you want to go to. You see what I mean? And I've seen people in the past who looked utterly ridiculous, you know, for a man of my tender years, with having teeth the same colour as a piano keyboard. You know what I mean? So yeah. I went for not quite the top colour. But anyway, look.
But how do you choose? I mean, there is a maxim they've always said that a woman should never have a wedding dress whiter than her teeth.
Oh, really?
So most people's teeth are nowhere near as white as a wedding dress, are they?
No, they're not. No, I totally agree. Mine aren't either, and I hope they won't be. But as I say, it works out over 2 days. So I'm afraid no coffee, no tea, no booze, no nothing, you know, for a couple of days. So that'll give me a health shake-up, and then we'll see how my teeth turn out.
But, yeah, but not only that, you've got to really avoid those things forever. Otherwise, they're just going to go brown again.
Well, no, that's not the case, you see, because you can have this done every year. It's a process by which you can redo it every year. And
is it safe?
Well, I've got a great dentist who I've had for 25 years, and my teeth are in perfect shape. In fact, he reminded me I hadn't been to see him for 2.5 years before I went yesterday. And that's because he, you know, we've said this before, I've either got implants or I've got crowns or whatever, but my teeth are in great shape. And I trust the guy implicitly. He's a doctor as well. He's, you know, he's not just a dentist. He's a doctor of something or other. So he's fully qualified to do all this. And I have to say, it gives you so much more confidence, because I do a bit more television these days, but also even the radio I do is now largely on YouTube. You know, it's all pictures and all that. So I needed the extra confidence to get my teeth looking better.
Oh, well, good luck to you. You know, yeah. It's your money. Yeah. How much did it cost, by the way?
£1,000.
Jesus, that's a lot of money.
Well, it's not really. Some people spend £20,000 getting their teeth done, you know what I mean, by having them all replaced individually. I'm pretty sure that Bill Wyman once said he had them all done like that, and it cost about 25 grand or something. But that's a very long process. That can take weeks, because the bolts they put into your gum, if you see what I mean, have to set in before they can attach the teeth to them and all that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, there we are.
Well, good luck. I hope it turns out to be dazzling, and that, you know, you'll be blinding me with your mouth.
Well, that's what I don't want to do, because then it looks so false, you know what I mean? So I just want it to look natural, and I think it will look pretty natural. But as I say, it's just to have the confidence to be able to smile, because I thought my teeth were going off a bit. They do with age anyway, but, you know, obviously there's deterioration in your teeth and all that. But I was starting to smile with my lips firmly together. And I didn't want to. I wanted to start smiling with showing my teeth, you know. So anyway, here we are. It was a very expensive day, actually, because You won't believe it. I came out of that and went straight to the opticians and got two new pairs of glasses because of all the glasses I've lost in lockdown by taking them off when they steamed up, you know, for the mask on. And that cost me another 850 quid. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so I'm afraid that it's probably a pretty good job. I'm not allowed to spend any money on booze at the moment. Can't afford it.
Have you got one of those chains that you hang around your neck?
No,
that you can attach your glasses to?
No, I'll probably get one now. It's really
I'm going to buy you one of those.
Good idea.
No, they are good. If you're inclined to stick your glasses on top of your head and then they fall off
whatever. Yeah. No, you're probably right. I'm sure you're right. Now then, Miss Jones, what I want to talk to you about is what I consider to be heresy within our profession. So Max Hastings was the editor of the Daily Telegraph. He was only Max Hastings then, okay? He'd been the editor of the London Evening Standard, which I never thought was a very good fit for a gentleman of his sort of background, you know, political historian, all that kind of stuff, you know. And then he goes on to become editor of the Daily Telegraph. For some bizarre reason, Diana, Princess of Wales, contacts him through her sort of people and asks if she can go down to his place in the home county somewhere. I think it might be Kent, but I'm not sure. And wanted to have a chat with him. So she went down and he was quite amazed, but he was happy to, you know, serve her tea or whatever she wanted for 2 hours, in which she spilled out the whole story of her disastrous and broken marriage to Prince Charles. No, it was horrible from day one. And guess what? Sir Max Hastings chose not to publish a word of it.
Well, he did the right thing.
Yes,
he did the right thing. Did you watch the Channel 4 programme?
No,
about the Diana interview with Martin Bashir.
So Max
was interviewed on this programme.
Yeah.
And he obviously realised what a desperately frail mental state Diana was in.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to contribute to her mental downfall. Unlike Martin Bashir, who appears to have duped her into doing the interview with fake bank statements and all kinds of other things.
Mm.
Actually, I thought that forgery was a crime in this country.
Mm.
So the BBC has got a lot to answer for here. And Martin Bashir, we now find out, is seriously ill with COVID.
Seriously ill with COVID, yeah.
So he couldn't be on the programme. But I think Max, his conscience is clear.
Yeah.
And he did the right thing. He obviously realised how fragile she was.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, I don't accept that at all. He could have said to her, look, what you've told me is extremely interesting information. I'm a newspaper editor. You've come to me. You must have come to me with the purpose that some of this will get into the public arena, surely. That's what she wanted.
She'd worked with Andrew Morton before, hadn't she? She'd kind of singled him out and given him... I mean, she didn't. This was interesting. She didn't actually ever give Andrew Morton a direct interview, one-to-one.
It was done through
a third party.
Yeah, it was all tapes. He went and picked up the tapes and then transcribed the tapes and all that. And that was also in future. She could say, I never met Andrew Morton and all this kind of stuff, you know. But one way or another, that information from Diana, Princess of Wales, was the scoop of the century in terms of what you could have published in a newspaper, pages and pages and pages of it. And Max Hastings should have found a way to, A, settle his conscience, and, B, provide the, you know, the public with the information Diana so badly wanted to get out.
Well, he obviously had to weigh up his relationship with the royal family as editor of the Daily Telegraph, which is, you know, the preferred paper of the royals.
Yeah.
He obviously had to consider the fact that Charles would be king one day and that he might have shot himself in the foot by running maverick stuff by Diana.
Self-interest. No newspaper editor should have self-interest. A newspaper editor should say, I have got the scoop of the century here. It is my duty within my profession as a journalist to make sure this is published.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying,
but
I can understand why he didn't run it. What was her intention? Do you think she wanted him to...
Her intention was to try and balance up the anti-Diana propaganda, which she felt was building up against her because Charles was the one getting all the access. Charles had already done, remember, the Dimbleby interview, okay, in which he'd admitted to infidelity. And she wanted it all balanced up, you know. And of course, eventually it was with Bashir. Isn't it interesting that Bashir, who you say, and the allegations are, that he provided these false bank statements, which he showed to Diana's brother, suggesting that somebody was taking payments for information from within the royal circle. Okay, that was the idea of them. But Bashir ended up as the religious correspondent of the BBC. Do you think that there's a certain irony to that, isn't there?
Well, he went to America, didn't he? And yeah. There were some dodgy reasons why he was relieved of his first job in the States. He went to another job.
Yeah.
That didn't work out either.
Yeah.
The odd thing is that the BBC had him back. But then I thought about this last night, having watched the programme.
Yeah.
And I thought, look, he's obviously got something over the BBC because some of this practice was untoward.
Yes.
And I thought it was fascinating that the BBC, well, they look hugely at fault, don't they? Mm. One minute they deny having any letters in their possession from Diana. The next minute they admit to having the letters. So who's telling the truth? Who's lying here? And what is the outcome of this? Follow the rabbit down the hole. What's going to happen to the BBC over this?
Yeah, well,
because it's hugely incremental, I would say.
Yeah, well, you made a very good point. You know, it started off with a conversation about Max Hastings as a journalist, ended up with the BBC and their standards and morals. I tell you the most interesting thing. You know, the controller of the BBC, who you and Mr. Tavern used to chase around at the time,
John Burt.
The most interesting line I've read in the whole saga of this, been following it now for weeks up to last night's programme, is that John Burt didn't even tell Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the BBC, that the programme was going out because, of course, Marmaduke Hussey's wife was lady-in-waiting to the Queen.
Yeah, I mean, it's all so involved and contrived, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
I think it was a mistake all round. No interviews should have been given. No television documentary should have been made. What I didn't know in terms of the Charles interview was that, in fact, there were two versions of it.
Yes. You say that, there's a lot of the Diana stuff still left on the cutting room floor, and there's a big panic now through the BBC and a lot of other sort of media institutions as to where is the other stuff and when will that emerge? Because apparently Diana said other things which were even stronger than the stuff that was eventually shown.
Her opinion that Charles wasn't cut out to be king and that he couldn't handle it is controversial, but it's only her opinion.
Yeah.
But if she had evidence on other matters, you know, I think we need to hear that, don't we?
Well, I totally agree. And it's a right old can of worms, isn't it? Anyway, getting away from royals to subjects to which certainly you are more familiar, Ms. Jones, and I like to look in from the outside. But the death of Spencer Davis, you tweeted out on this guy this week. I think that's because he's a fellow Welsh person, but actually a little bit before your time.
Rather a lot before my time, actually.
Yeah.
He was 81 when he died this week. God bless Spencer.
Yeah.
A good Swansea boy, wasn't he? They were one of the hottest groups in pop before you and I really got into that kind of thing. But it was not so much pop. It was soul and R&B.
Yeah.
And, of course, they had these brothers in the band, Muff and Steve Winwood.
That's right.
And so Muff was the bass player. He went on to work at CBS years later, which became Sony Music. Steve Winwood obviously went solo.
Yeah.
But during that time that they had the voice of little Stevie Winwood, who was only a teenager.
He was 15 when he first met him.
15,
and the reason his brother was in the group was because at 15 they were frightened of being done on child labour laws. So they got his elder brother in the group as his chaperone.
Yes, and actually Muff was a good bass player as well, so there wasn't a problem there, yeah. But I think after they left, they quit the band, didn't they, after only a couple of years?
Yes.
They didn't have many hits, but I mean, we all remember them. Gimme Some Loving.
Yeah, Gimme Some Loving.
Keep On Running. Somebody Help Me.
Keep On Running. Keep On Hiding. Yeah. Oh, no, they made about three or four great records and then they just disappeared off the scene. But although they weren't of our generation, I do remember as a kid, you know, in the 60s, listening to those records on my little transistor radio up in my bedroom, you know what I mean? And they were a sound of the 60s without a shadow of a doubt, you know.
Yes, at a time when there was so much competition.
Yes, yes.
Here's an interesting factoid for you. Did you know that Spencer Davis had a cameo as a bus passenger in the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour?
Yes, I did. I read that in one of the obituaries. Yeah, that was very interesting, wasn't it? Also, Stevie Winwood is apparently a boy genius. You know, at 15... Spencer Davis walks into a club in Birmingham, sees this kid playing a piano and singing, thought he had a voice like Ray Charles and played the piano like, you know, sort of Einstein. Don't know if Einstein ever played
the piano. I'm not sure Einstein played the piano, but Winifred Apfel did.
Absolutely. And of course, Stevie Winwood was at the front of the group. But do you know the other thing that amazes me is, I don't know whether Stevie Winwood then went away and formed Traffic, okay? And they made a fantastic song. And one of the lines was, and all that I knew was the hole in my shoe, which was letting in water. And you know what? When I think of that song now, it's a parallel almost to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And I'm not sure which one came first.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have to look that one up.
Well, there's a line in the one I've just told you about, you know, 10,000 tin soldiers standing at my shoulders and all that I knew was... And it's all fantastical stuff, a bit like, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Or Someone Left My Cake Out in the Rain.
Someone Left My Cake Out in the Rain.
Do you remember that? Yeah, it was Richard Harris, wasn't it?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Anyway, there you go. Listen, that's nostalgia in the pop world. We also get too deep into nostalgia while there's so much going on in the world at the moment. Now, would you ever buy a velvet jacket again, Miss Jones?
Well, I don't have to because half of my wardrobe is velvet.
No, indeed.
And a lot of my velvet gowns, cloaks and jackets are older than my children. They come out every year and I wear them all through the Christmas season.
I can't believe it.
I will this year. Yeah, absolutely true.
It's a very
70s thing, isn't it?
I think velvet is so naff.
Why?
Velvet jacket. I mean, I remember sort of... I wasn't even old enough to buy one myself. I remember thinking how pathetic men looked in velvet suits, don't you think?
I don't think it's for men.
Exactly.
I think it's a very feminine fabric, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is a very feminine fabric. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think for women, fine. But I read somewhere, you know, in one of my journals that, you know, it's been revived now. Everybody's going to be wearing it. Men will be wearing it. Oh, my God. It says here, look, slinky, soft and subtly sexy. Get some velvet. Want to dress up? We have the answer and you'll want to stroke it. Well, that's not a very good reason for wearing clothes, is it? Because people want to stroke you, huh?
Well, I tell you what you could try, velvet underpants. How about that?
No, you must be joking. That must have been the...
If you wear them inside out, they'd be nice and soft.
Oh, listen, Miss Jones, this is a family show. Please don't get onto things like that. Velvet Underground, yes, that was a group, wasn't it? But not Velvet Underpants. Yeah.
Yes.
Now then,
maybe they should have been called Velvet Underpants.
Maybe they should have been, yeah. Also, what do you think about the rich man syndrome? Because I've read about a lot of women this week moaning about how difficult and painful it always is married to a rich man when you've got a choice of two or three houses, when you're expected to join him aboard his yacht, you know, because he's conducting some, you know, high-powered business affairs and all that. It's all such a pain in the ass. I mean, what are these women moaning about?
I think it's very interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, there is an image of how hard can it be?
Yes.
You've got all the money in the world, all the houses, all the yachts, all the cars.
Yep.
You can buy as many clothes as you want. That gets boring pretty soon, I think.
Yeah.
And there is a great image in this piece I read by Helen Kerwin Taylor in the Daily Mail.
That's the one.
About pot-bellied men prancing about in bathrobes, screaming into their mobile phones at detox clinics for oligarchs and CEOs. It says it all, doesn't it, really?
Yes.
I just thought, oh, that is the least attractive kind of man I can imagine. Mm. And money isn't everything.
Mm. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I've seen that sort of behaviour, you know, sometimes. I'll tell you who was guilty of it, Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell, you know, the man who turned out to be a complete crook, stole your father's pension money. So you know a lot more about him probably than I do. But he used to treat people with such disdain. He'd have this huge jar of caviar on his desk in his office in Colmore Circus, I think it was, wasn't it? The HQ of the Mirror in those days.
Yeah, on the top floor. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and he had a helicopter pad above that and all that kind of stuff. And you sit there putting Jacob's cream cracker wafers into this bowl of caviar, you know, and scoop it out and eat it constantly. It's all over his mouth, you know, because caviar's black, obviously.
How disgusting. You don't want to eat that with your shiny new teeth, do you?
Well, I certainly don't. You're absolutely right about that. And the way he would sort of snap at people, you know, and bark at them, and total disrespect. Man was a complete pig, honestly, in terms of manners and all that kind of stuff. But he also, you know, I read the books about him later after he died. And apparently he was like that to his wife and his children. You know, if they were at home at this amazing sort of manor house in Oxford they had, which was actually a council house. He rented it from the council. It was a huge baronial sort of mansion, you know, but he rented it from the council. And, you know, if they were going out and his wife would sort of, you know, as wives do, get his coat off the hook and bring it towards him, he'd say, "I don't want a fucking coat tonight. We're going in the car. Now put it away," you know, and all this kind of stuff. And a very unpleasant man. So I can imagine if you lived in that sort of, you know, atmosphere, it must have been very unpleasant.
Oh, the most telling anecdote I read about him, his poor wife, Elizabeth, had said that one Christmas, Christmas Eve it was, and they had a gloriously big tree down in the hallway and piles of presents for all the children. There were lots of children, weren't there? About six, I think.
Yeah.
And she'd, you know, been shopping for weeks and she'd wrapped it all up and it was all ribboned and beautiful. And he came down during the early hours and he ripped open all the children's presents because he just couldn't bear that they weren't for him.
What? What a nutter. What do you mean he couldn't bear they weren't for him? He's supposed to be a multimillionaire. He could have bought himself anything. We didn't know.
Of course, but it's all about gifts, isn't it? And somebody of that frame of mind has to be centre stage. They're so egocentric.
Yes.
And they just can't bear the idea of somebody else having pleasure in something that doesn't involve them.
God.
He was a very psychologically strange man.
Yeah, I had a pretty strange relationship with my father all my life, you know. And it's horrible. You know, it's a horrible atmosphere in the house. You just want to stay away from it, to be honest. That's why I couldn't wait to get away as quickly as possible. And it was all about that sort of, you know, domination thing. You know what I mean? It's my house, my rules, you know, what I say goes and all that kind of stuff. And it is pretty unpleasant. But he was so gorged on his own ego, wasn't he? It must have been even more unpleasant there. Now, Ms. Jones, come on, we've got to get serious for a minute. Plenty of reports around this week that more people now are dying of non-COVID illnesses than of COVID illnesses because of the close down of hospitals. I mean, this is not good, is it?
You think hospitals are closing down?
They're closing down admission to patients who should have been treated for lung conditions, heart conditions, and all sorts of other conditions. You know, even the deputy chief medical officer, Mr. Van Dam, now is saying that, you know, we've got to ease lockdown up, particularly for the health of other people.
Yeah, I mean, every area health authority is different, isn't it?
Yes.
I've had to go in for a couple of x-rays and some specialist treatment, and I've had that very promptly. I'm in Southeast London. We've got King's as one of the major teaching hospitals.
Yeah.
And I think, touch wood, I've been fortunate. I know that that's not the case all around the country. And there does need to be balance. You know, people do still need their cancer treatment, their heart treatment. They need emergency treatment for all kinds of, you know, accidents are still going on, for example, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So I think that they just need to strike a balance.
Yeah, but it's people being frightened to go into hospitals now, you see. I had to go into my heart hospital, you know, because I'd missed, having it checked out for such a long time. And you know, you do get nervous about the number of people walking around in masks and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, look, that's something we've just got to cope with. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Myself and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. One of your showbiz mates, Leslie Ann, Oscar-winning lyricist Don Black, has stepped down from presenting his Sunday night show on Radio 2 this month and been inundated with complaints. Is this another terrible incident of the BBC, who we've already spoken about in this podcast, an attack of ageism?
Why have they done this? I mean, he's really good on that show.
Yeah.
It's one of the things you look forward to on a Sunday night, you know, especially if I'm driving,
right,
which I quite often am on a Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. And, you know, I love listening to Don. Why get rid of him when he has such an enthusiastic listenership?
Mm.
I felt the same when they took Paul Jones off the blues show,
right,
and they put the dreadful Keris Matthews on there, who, to me, gives Matthews Welsh people a bad name. She sounds like a Disney Welsh character.
Yeah.
You know, she sounds completely fake. Mm. Somebody else is doing her playlist for her. I always felt, listening to Paul Jones, that I was getting his real, genuine record collection.
Yeah.
And I felt that with Don Black. Black as well. He's a lovely character, a brilliant raconteur, and I can't see how they can replace him.
He's wrote a few good songs himself, hasn't he? Or written?
Yeah, Born Free.
Yeah, absolutely.
And has collaborated with so many people down the years. My favourite of his was the musical Tell Me on a Sunday, which Marcy Webb starred in originally. And then they had Denise Van Outen sort of did a comeback version of it, which wasn't so good for me. But the songs are brilliant. Great lyricist, wonderful guy, always so friendly and so low-key and, doesn't big himself up and so on. We need more people like him.
He insists, by the way, on a piece I read that he left voluntarily, but he makes a big thing about, you know, I don't understand this rush towards youth audiences and all that kind of stuff. Now, Ms. Jones, you had a very interesting life, you know, professionally and domestically and personally. So I read this piece in a newspaper. It's a debate between two, really outstanding lady journalists about whether a woman should wait around until she finds her perfect husband. Should women really hold out for Mr. Perfect? No, says a lady called Linda Kelsey. But yes, says a woman called Roanne Pelling. I mean, is that realistic for any woman in this day and age to say, no, he's not Mr. Perfect. I'm rejecting him and I'm going to find somebody else.
So Linda Kelsey, who's been banging on about this kind of stuff for years, she makes a point of saying that her ideal man is a tall guy, but she's settled for somebody rather short. She's been married before. She's had relationships before.
But I ended up settling for a short ass.
I'm sorry. I think. Yeah. And Roanne Pelling is the Mail's sex columnist.
Right. Oh, really? Yeah.
And I think, you know, she's driving at perfection or nothing, which I kind of agree with. I've always said since my own divorce that it's better to be on your own than with the wrong person.
Right. Yeah, but
actually know when you look. Yeah. You sometimes tell yourself, I've got the right person, but even they turn out to be the wrong person. And also people change.
Yes.
But I think if you're hung up on things like he's got to be 6'10" and he's got to weigh, 14 stone and he's got to have great dress sense and he's got to share my taste in music and all that kind of thing, you are better off on your own because you're too demanding. Relationships are all about compromise, and you get to a certain stage in your life when actually you just can't be asked.
No, I totally agree. I feel sorry for people who have to have somebody else in their life because they sacrifice their own life for some other value, which I've never understood. I mean, look, I suppose I'm a little bit different because I've basically been single most of my life. That is, I've never got married. I've lived with people for short periods of time, just months really, you know, but generally speaking, always. But I do know people who simply cannot exist on their own. They're frightened of going home to an empty house, even though funnily enough, a former editor you and I have both worked for just could not stand being on his own, hated it, you know, and had a bust up with his wife once, moved into a flat and wouldn't go home because he couldn't stand an empty house and he needed company and he wanted people around him. And I've never been like that. I tell you what, you're very, very lucky if you've got the quality that I'm talking about, being able to exist alone, because then you're not handing, you know, the passage of your life into somebody else's hands.
I think some people go from the parental home.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot of men do this. This is a traditional route for men, isn't it? They can't look after themselves. So mummy has always done everything for them. Change the bed, wash the sheets, iron the shirts, provide the meals, all of that. And they can't fathom how they're going to exist by themselves and do all that and work at a job. So they go from mummy and daddy into a marriage quite young. And then that marriage might not survive for whatever reason. And they'll go into another one and then maybe even another marriage after that.
Yeah.
And they've got used to the idea of being looked after. Yeah. I think that's what it is with many men. Whereas women tend to be more self-sufficient domestically. And we can exist for long periods of time by ourselves.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, I had an experience with a woman once who was married, right? But we were, you know, sort of going out together.
You were at that again, were you?
Well, no. Her marriage was failing, so that's my defense.
They always say that.
No, yeah. I was helping. I was helping her.
You were helping the marriage to fail.
No, I was helping her emotionally. Helping her emotionally.
Of course you were.
Her emotional crutch. And
did you just say crutch on a podcast?
Yeah, but I mean the sort of crutch that a cripple needs, you know. I mean,
it gets worse.
He wasn't a cripple, obviously, you know. But,
family show.
Yeah, exactly. It's family show. But no, what was interesting was we had, you know, we'd been seeing each other about 3 months, and she suddenly announced, I'm going to leave my husband. I said, well, I said, that's a...
Better not.
I said, that's a big move, isn't it? I said, what are you going to do? You're going to get a little flat of your own or move into, your friend? She had a friend who had done quite well, and she had a flat with a spare bedroom, you know what I mean? So I thought, well, automatically she'll move in there, you know. She said, no, I want to move straight in with you. And I said, well, I'm not sure that's a great idea. And her life pattern had been, she got married, she lived at home till she was 21, then she got married and moved in with her husband, and then had 10 years of marriage, and then if she ever had a breakup, she moved back in with her mum, you see what I mean? She'd never lived on her own and terribly feared living on her own, and wanted a commitment immediately to another solid relationship, which, of course, I wasn't able to give.
You never really find out who you are, do you, if you never live by yourself? No. Have you watched, I have to ask you, because I've been absolutely glued to it. I don't generally watch much television, but I can't stop watching this thing, Married at First Sight. Have you seen it?
No, and I don't feel like watching something like that. I think it would be so pathetic. I would cringe at the idea of two people walking up the altar, meeting each other for the first time, and then being expected to consummate their relationship that night. I couldn't bear to watch a program.
Oh, well, they
like
don't
that.
Have to do that. They, you know, there's no kind of obligation to get straight down to it, as it were.
Right.
But they do follow them over the honeymoon period and then over a period of about 3 months as they are getting to know each other.
Right.
And of course, the most recent ones have been having to do that through lockdown and so on.
Yeah.
And I can't, it's horrifying. I can't take my eyes off it.
Yeah. What's so horrifyingly attractive about it?
It's not attractive. It's deeply unattractive. But it's the thought of how desperate would you be? How hard had you tried to find Mr. or Miss Wright and you just hadn't been able to? That you would make marriage vows to somebody you'd never set eyes on before in your life.
Yeah.
Because to me, that destroys the sanctity of marriage.
Oh, I totally agree. I think it's I just think the whole thing's rubbish, you know, and again, it shows this desperate need. I've got to be with somebody to the extent I'll marry somebody I don't even know. I mean, I think it's awful, but there we are. Tell me, during the course of your journalistic career, your very successful journalistic career, Miss Jones, how many times did you actually go to a boss and say, I want a pay rise? Because I was reading a piece by what's his name? Martin Bell, okay, recently. And he was talking about his life as a reporter and all that. And he said he loved working for the BBC so much and that he felt so privileged, you know, to be the BBC man in foreign climes, covering wars and all that kind of stuff, that he didn't ask for a pay rise for the whole 33 years he worked at the BBC. That wouldn't have done me if I was going up the old, greasy pole towards the top as a top broadcaster. I'd have asked for more dosh, wouldn't you?
No, I never once asked for a pay rise because I always thought that they were paying me more than I was worth anyway, and that if I asked for more money, they might sack me.
My goodness me, where is your self-respect here, Ms. Jones? I just don't get it. You were a brilliant journalist, a top interviewer, you know, always willing and able to, you know, get through locked doors and talk to people. You should have demanded a higher return.
The one time it happened, I was offered a job by a rival newspaper.
Right.
And I went to see my showbiz editor to say, you know, I've been offered this amazing job and it's this much money and I get this kind of all this package. And he said, oh, we'll see about that. And he did go off to see the editor and they did come back with a better offer.
Right.
And I did wind up staying. But then years later, I had a conversation with Jean Rook about it. And she went, tut, tut, tut. Mm. She said, always cross the street for more money, darling.
Yeah. Well, I knew Jean very well. Jean was the first lady of Fleet Street when she was writing columns in the Daily Express. I was the news editor. And Jean was great. She used to come to me the day before she had to write a column and take me out for large drinks, you know, because I was always inspirational to her in her ideas for a column, you know. And she was great company anyway, so I didn't mind, you know. Have a great lunch and then she'd literally go back to the office and write her column for 2 days later, you see what I mean? And she was great. But she, of course, came to the Express from the Mail, and then the Mail had to replace her, and they replaced her with the woman who became more famous than Jean, Linda Lee Potter, didn't they?
Fanny with the fringe, as they used to call her.
What?
Sobs. Yeah, I loved Linda. I was devoted to Linda. Yeah. I was assigned to her when I was first there, right. And she, you know, showed me the ropes.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And you're absolutely right. Jean did chase the money all the time. It's a tragic story about Jean, which I may have told before, but I'm not sure I had. But Jean eventually got cancer, sadly, and she was in, she wasn't in a hospital. She was in a sort of end of life type place.
Yeah, a hospice.
Yeah, a hospice, that's right, yeah. And anyway, Nick Lloyd, the editor, you know, had been trying to find time to go and see her and eventually did. And we got in the car and we're on our way down there. And it was in the very early days of mobile phones, but we still managed to receive a message by a bleep or something saying, turn around, Jean's died. And so we never got to see her.
That's very sad.
It is very sad.
She probably would have been lying there waiting for Nick to come and see her. And
she had a drink before she died. And I've heard that phenomenon from several sources. Just before, I know three people who just before they died suddenly sat up in bed and said, let's have a drink now, go and get the sherry. And it happened to Jean. And they had a drink and then died.
Yeah, that is common. I remember when my grandmother died.
Really?
She was in the hospital. She was 86.
Yeah.
She was in the hospital across the road from where my parents live. And I went in to see her sort of fairly late on a Sunday evening. And she'd been ailing. She hadn't been expected to make a comeback at that point.
Yeah.
And she said to me, I think I'll go home next week.
Yeah.
And sent me out to bring a little drink. And we did have one last drink. I just got married. And I took her the framed wedding portrait.
Oh, lovely.
And she hugged it to herself like it was a teddy bear.
Yeah.
And she took her little, you know, when you could get those little bottles of wine from Marks and Spencer.
Yes.
And she had a little drink. And I went back home to Mum and Dad and said, Nana says she's coming home next week. And they looked at each other.
Yeah.
And she died the next day.
Yeah. Funnily enough, my mother went to see my father in hospital, you know, in the last few days of his life. And he said to her, next time you come, Joan, you know, tomorrow, bring a suitcase, will you? I want to pack up and go home. And he died the day after.
It's a funny thing. It's that last kind of hurrah,
yeah,
isn't it?
And a mate of mine, whose brother was about 63 or 64, wasn't terribly old. He'd contracted some sort of, I think it was sort of stomach cancer or something like that, you know, which was horrible. And again, he was in a hospice, right? And they went to see him, and he literally said, somebody go and find a bottle of sherry. Come on, I really do fancy a glass of sherry. And they all sat round the bed, had the bottle of sherry, had a couple of glasses each, left, and he died that night. It was just amazing. You know, he'd been almost in a sort of coma. And when they were in the room and, you know, he could squeeze hands and all that, he suddenly sat up and said, let's have a drink. Another funny one, and I don't know why we're going on about this, but when I worked in Manchester at the Express, there was a lovely guy there who was a photographer. He was such a vivacious bloke in the sense that he had loads of energy rushing around Manchester, got on with all the footballers, used to go to the footballers' parties and all that kind of stuff. His name was Peter, but I can't remember his surname. He went to Malta on a diving holiday. He was a bit of a sort of scuba diver, you know what I mean? And he went with a mate. And do you know what happened? They came back from, you know, an afternoon out. They used to do 1 hour scuba diving and 9 hours drinking a day, you know, and came back. And he went onto the balcony with a glass in his hand, rested on the balcony railing, and it gave way. And he fell 4 floors down to, you know, the concrete below. It was a shocking situation.
Was he killed?
Well, I'm about to tell you. He was in a coma for the next 2 days. And then his mate, who stayed by his bedside all the time, was suddenly amazed when Peter sat up and said, I need a drink. Go and get me a drink. The guy went out, told the doctors and said, he's better. And they said, what? He got him a drink. He had a drink and he died.
No way.
Yeah, honestly, it was amazing.
Well, way to go in a way, isn't it?
Yes, I know. Yeah, but anyway, enough of all that. Listen, what about, we talk often enough on this podcast about John Lennon. What about Sir Paul McCartney, eh, who has single-handedly put together McCartney 3? My God, I remember buying McCartney 1, you know, the first solo album with the picture of the bowl of cherries on it, and he played every instrument on that. And he has apparently now played every instrument on this one, including Leslie Ann. I've seen a picture of Sir Paul McCartney with a double bass.
Yeah, he's multi-instrumental, isn't he? He's a genius. He's done all of this during lockdown all by himself. Mm. He's got a recording studio, of course, at his house down at Peasmosh.
Yeah.
And I haven't been to his place in Long Island, but he's bound to have recording facilities there as well.
Yeah.
And he has a private plane, so he can nip back and forth between the two whenever he likes.
Yeah, sure.
And he takes that plane up to Liverpool, of course, as well.
Yeah.
And he will nip in for the day and then just go back to Long Island or to Sussex from there. Look, this is what he does. Mm. Why would he stop?
Yeah.
He's 78. Yeah. Why would he give up? This is what we expect of Sir Paul McCartney. I can't wait to get it. It's not out till December, though.
Right, okay. I remember the first one so well. I mean, I was shaking with excitement at the idea. You know, in those days we had vinyl and you had the beautifully photographed covers and all that. And the bowl of cherries on the back was explained to me later as, well, that's Paul McCartney after the Beatles just telling the world life is not a bowl of cherries, which I thought was very sort of, you know, mystical in those days. And I thought most of the songs were pretty poor, actually. They sounded like half songs to me, but it didn't matter because it was Paul McCartney and he sung them. The only decent one was not The Long and Winding Road. What was the ballad on McCartney One? Do you know what I'm talking about? Long and Winding Road was on Let It Be, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
too many to remember, aren't there?
Yeah,
it wasn't Maybe I'm Amazed, was it?
Yes, it was. Well done.
Yeah,
well done.
Okay.
Maybe I'm amazed at the way or whatever. You know, I don't ever know.
You love me all the time. Yeah, what a song that is. I would stick my neck out and say that's actually the best song he ever composed.
Well, it was a brilliant song. The rest of the stuff were little ditties, things like, you know, handlebars, motor cars. Bicycles for two.
Yeah, but so sweet and poignant. And I was just so in love with McCartney. Yes. He couldn't put a foot wrong for me.
No, he couldn't, I agree. Well, there you go. So there's McCartney 3 coming out very soon. And I don't know how people gauge record sales these days, because where would you go and buy a record if you wanted it?
Well, Amazon.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
But a lot of people are streaming records now. And the interesting thing about that, it's not so great for the artist.
Yeah.
You don't actually have to buy the whole album. You can buy the tracks individually.
Yeah.
So that has obviously dented album sales.
Yeah.
And not all the tracks on an album come out as a single.
No.
In the old days, it used to be 3 or 4 tracks at the most that would be released as singles.
Yeah.
But of course, back in the Beatles' day, they always had a policy of, because they didn't want to shortchange the fans, if they put out a single, they didn't include it on the album.
Yeah.
The album had to be all new tracks.
Yeah, wow, it's amazing the way...
So times have changed, haven't they?
Well, absolutely. Now, I'm afraid we've got a couple of... Well, we've certainly got one sad anniversary, and that is the fact that it's the commemoration, I think, of your father's funeral today, is it not, Leslie-Ann?
It's unbelievable. I don't know where a year went.
Mm.
But one of the things that stands out is a strange thing.
Yeah.
George Cohen, who was in the famous
World
Cup winning side of 1966, he was a great friend of my father's. They stayed close all their lives.
Mm.
And it was his birthday on the day of my dad's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen this before.
Yeah.
And I think my mum wasn't all that pleased, actually, but a lot of people there thought it was a great thing.
Yeah.
When somebody stood up and said, by the way, it's George Cohen's 80th birthday today.
Mm-hmm.
Let's all sing happy birthday. And there we all were, singing happy birthday to George in front of my father's coffin.
Oh, amazing. But I think your father would have been okay with that, because they're a big
friend. Of course he would, yeah. He would have thought that it was funny, actually.
Yeah.
But I think my mum was, you know, in a somber mood, understandably, perhaps didn't think it was quite appropriate.
No, exactly. And of course, that means that today, as we're recording this podcast, is George Cohen's 81st birthday. So happy birthday indeed to George Cohen, as you quite right.
Many happy returns, George. We love you.
Indeed, England legend. Now, whilst you've been under lockdown, Miss Jones, have you been baking bread?
No, don't be daft.
Apparently, no. It's the new thing now. Everybody's doing it, but not normal bread, like bread that, you know, you put jam, butter and jam on. I'm talking about things like banana bread.
I know. I have made banana bread a couple of times. It's one of those things, when you make it, the kids just go woof and they eat the whole thing in about 3 seconds.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, it is a very nice thing to have.
Oh, I used to love banana bread.
You know, baking is laborious, and I'm writing a book at the moment, and I actually just don't even have time to, you know, run downstairs in the evening and open the fridge and see what falls out and eat it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
It takes time to do baking and cooking.
Probably. Well, John Lennon did, didn't he? When he became a house father to Sean, he it's his famous quote, isn't it? Oh, I just stayed indoors and baked bread.
Baked bread, cooked brown rice, and changed Sean's nappies. That was pretty much it for 5 years. He soon got bored with it.
Yeah, of course he did. And then he came out and started making great music again. Now, I used to love all those things. There's carrot cake, banana bread, lemon drizzle cake I could eat until I burst. I just used to love it.
I thought you were going to say eat until I burp.
No. I never burp.
Family show.
Exactly, family show. And you've got to have some etiquette, you know, on this show.
Etiquette? What's that?
You know what etiquette is, don't you?
Etiquette, darling.
Yeah, all right. Whatever you say. Of course, the onset of diabetes 2 means all that had to go, you know. But fortunately, so did most of the diabetes as well. But if I took back to the only time I ever indulge now in a bit of chocolate or something like that is Christmas, when I actually go on strike for a day against the chocolate and devour a tin of Quality Street.
But what whole tin?
Well, all the best ones I like out of it, you know what I mean?
And, so which ones are your favourites?
I like the solid chocolate ones with the mint crisps in it.
What colour is that?
Green.
Oh, yeah, the green one, yeah.
And,
do you like the purple one?
I like the purple one. I also
My favourite.
I like the flat toffee one, okay? Wrapped
up. Oh, no, that gets stuck in my teeth.
Yeah, well, I don't like sure, you know, I eat that carefully for obvious reasons.
I hate the strawberry one. Yeah. That's just, it tastes like sick.
Oh, golly, that's a horrible expression. But you're absolutely right. It's not much good. But, of course, in recent years, the big favourite has been the one with all the little marathons and bounty bars and Mars bars in them. I love those as well. So,
what are they called? Celebrations or something?
Celebrations, that's right. I get stuck in there.
Yeah.
So there we are. Right. Okay, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed for your company today. Just one thing to say before we go. Today is the anniversary of the day that Sandy Shaw's Always Something There to Remind Me got to number one in the 60s. But of course, it's before our time.
Who ever told Sandy Shaw that she could sing?
Well, that's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Always out of tune, wasn't it? Well, just awful. And she was a terribly arrogant woman.
Like a puppet on a string. Boom, boom, boom.
And you know she never used to wear shoes, did she, in the studio?
Never used to. That was her gimmick. But as usual, it was something that happened by accident. So the first time she did a TV show, apparently, she literally misplaced her shoes or her heel fell off or something. So she said, I can't wear a shoe without one heel. So she took them off. And that became her gimmick, didn't it?
She had really crabby feet, you know. Take a shoe, walk around with no shoes on if you've got pretty feet. Yeah. But she had Parmesan heels.
Okay, so we've got a woman here with Parmesan heels who can't sing, completely out of tune, who got 5 number one hits.
Well, it shows what taste the British public has.
Yeah, well,
I guess.
Yeah, but she disappeared off the scene pretty quickly, like a lot of those people in the 60s, but she's still alive somewhere.
Easy come, easy go.
Easy come, easy go. There you go. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. And you must now return to your typewriter and keep writing your book, because I know it's going to be another classic. And of course, you will be keeping a beady eye on sales of your John Lennon book, yes?
Oh, definitely. We're best selling in Germany now, you know. Wow. We've charged up the charts, and I'm just working with the US publishers at the moment because we publish there on the 1st of December.
Oh, really? Oh, well, that's another anniversary to look forward to. I know this might sound like a stupid question, but is your John Lennon book in Germany actually published in German?
No, it's in French. What do you think? I mean, obviously it's in German.
I thought that, you know, English is such a worldwide spoken language and the Germans are all so bright. I thought they wouldn't bother translating it.
Yeah, no, they have. It's all different publishers. So we're coming out in over the next few months in China, France, Germany's already out, Romania, Italy, Spain, Japan, ooh, Czech Republic, Estonia, Brazil. Yeah. That's a huge market for us.
Ooh, golly.
USA, obviously, Finland, Russia, Taiwan. The Hungarian cover I just got in last week, that's looking good.
Golly.
Bulgaria, Slovenia, all kinds of countries. And yes, they're all in those local languages.
Brilliant.
But the English-speaking world is obviously huge.
Yeah.
So it's already out in territories like Australia, New Zealand, and various other who speak our mother tongue.
Brilliant. Well, as it's reached the top in Germany now, we'll finish this podcast with one exclamation. Donner und Blitzen! Schweinhund! Schwein! Schwein, John Lennon!
Calm down, dear. Have another Quality Street.
Stevie Winwood is apparently a boy genius. You know, at 15, Spencer Davis walks into a club in Birmingham, sees this kid playing a piano and singing, thought he had a voice like Ray Charles and played the piano like, sort of Einstein. Don't know if Einstein ever played
the piano. Sure. I'm not sure Einstein played the piano, but Winifred Atwell did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, funnily enough, I had an experience with a woman once who was married, right? But we were, you know, sort of going out together.
You were at that again, were you?
Well, no. Her marriage was failing, so that's my defense.
They always say that.
No, yeah. I was helping. I was helping her. You know,
you were helping the marriage to fail.
No, I was helping her emotionally. Helping her emotionally. I was,
yeah, of course you were. Yeah,
I was her emotional crutch. And
did you just say crutch on a podcast?
Yeah, but I mean the sort of crutch that a cripple needs. You know, I mean, to lean.
It gets worse.
You wasn't a cripple, obviously. You know, but
family show.
Yeah, exactly. It's family show. Lemon drizzle cake I could eat until I burst. I just used to love it.
I thought you were going to say eat until I burp.
No. I never burp.
Family show.
Exactly, family show. I've got to have some etiquette, you know, on this show.
Etiquette?
You know what etiquette is, don't you?
Etiquette, darling.
Yeah, all right. Whatever you say.